Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Adam Tanner, the San Francisco Bureau Chief for Reuters News Service. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Frank Lin, father of John Walker Lin, the man who became known worldwide in the months following the September 11, 2001 attacks in the United States. Frank Lin is an attorney at Pacific Gas and Electric's legal department in San Francisco. A graduate of Georgetown University's law school, he served in the mid-1980s as a law clerk in the Justice Department during the Reagan administration. Among those he worked with at the time was Samuel Alito, the current Supreme Court nominee. Mr. Lin also worked as a social worker for a time and has a master's degree in social work from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Mr. Lin first gained mention in the national media in 1985 when a power outage forced a cancellation of a bar exam for a group of law students, which included himself. His reaction was quoted at that time in the Washington Post. In more recent years, he has handled some prominent PG&E cases during the California power crisis, for which he was mentioned 11 times, according to the Factiva database of news articles. By contrast, the same database lists Frank Lin in more than 1,100 articles in connection with his son, who was sentenced to a 20-year prison sentence in 2002 and a plea deal after the son was captured on the battlefield in late 2001 in Afghanistan with Taliban forces. Earlier, the son had even met Osama bin Laden, apparently emerging from the encounter unimpressed. Mr. Lin has written that, to be sure, this was an unwise choice. John acted impulsively with misplaced idealism and without conferring with his family. His son was raised as a Catholic and went to Afghanistan after becoming a devout Muslim. For more than a year, Mr. Lin has sought a commutation of his son's sentence by appealing to President George W. Bush. John Walker Lin, now 24, is serving out his sentence in Southern California. Frank Lin also has two other children, both of whom are students. Please welcome Frank Lin.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity to appear before the Commonwealth Club, and I'm certainly conscious as I stand here of the very distinguished history of speakers here, including Franklin Roosevelt. And as a speaker, I can assure you I'm really unworthy of the honor. You might say that I'm just a father whose son got into some trouble. But I believe the case of John Lin is actually an important story and worthy of this audience's attention, so I appreciate your interest and your attention. In simple terms, this is the story of a decent and honorable young man embarked on a spiritual quest who became the focus of the grief and anger of an entire nation over an event in which he had no part. And I refer, of course, to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. The reason that I think this story is important is because the system, our system, broke down in the case of John Lin. See if I can get this machine to work. My goals today are first just to tell you the story of John Lin. Second, to ask you to reflect, based on the facts of John's case, on the importance and the fragility of our Constitution, of the rights we enjoy under our Constitution. And my third point is to suggest that the so-called war on terrorism lacks a hearts and minds component. I may have to ask for some help with the technical aspect here to get this slideshow going. Maybe I better just proceed. And I certainly welcome your questions at the conclusion of my remarks. I wanted to begin by asking you to call to mind the September 11th terrorist attacks and the shock and the horror they engendered in the hearts of everyone. On that awful day, a band of terrorists who claimed Islam as their cause hijacked four airplanes and flew three of them full of passengers into occupied buildings without warning, the World Trade Center Twin Towers in New York and the Pentagon in Washington. They crashed the fourth airplane into a field in Pennsylvania, also filled with passengers. 3,000 innocent Americans lost their lives that day. As President Roosevelt said about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, September 11th was a day that will live in infamy. This was a sneak attack carried out against a peaceful nation by a hidden and devious enemy, and it was rightly perceived by all Americans as an attack. And indeed, the New York Times, if I had my slideshow, I would show you this headline in the New York Times on the 12th of September, in which it says in very large letters, U.S. attacked. The 9/11 terrorist attacks form the backdrop against which the events of John Lynn's case unfold. But for those attacks, John's activities, which I will describe, would have been treated with indifference or perhaps curiosity here in the United States. But viewed through the prism of the September 11th attacks, those very same activities caused this young man to be vilified as a traitor and a terrorist. I would like to turn now, though, to just the subject of John. Oh, here we are. We have our slides. These are my context. I think I'm going backwards. I'm sorry. John Lynn's biography. John was born in February 1981 in Washington, D.C., during a time when I was working in the federal government. He's the second of my three children. John was named in part for John Marshall, the great Chief Justice of the United States. I had just finished reading a biography of Justice Marshall within a day or two before John was born, and he is one of my great heroes. It's said that the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia cracked in 1835 when it was ringing upon the death of Justice Marshall there in Philadelphia. John was also named after John Lennon, the Beatle. Marilyn, John's mother, and I both are big Beatles fans and John Lennon fans. And finally, we also chose the name John because it means gift from God. John was the kind of kid that any parent would want. From the time he was a baby, he was very centered and peaceful and content. Later, after he converted to Islam, I told John that I thought he had always been a Muslim, and he simply had to find it for himself. John's mother is also a very competent photographer, and so we have these lovely pictures of him as a child. I'm a practicing Catholic myself, though, and John, we raised John as a Catholic, and he attended Sunday school along with his brother in Washington while we were living there. In 1991, when John was 10 years old, our family of five at that point, Marilyn, my older son, Connell, John, and our daughter, Naomi, we moved from the D.C. area out here to the Bay Area because my job, I was working in a law firm, and they asked me to move to their San Francisco office. At age 12, John saw the movie Malcolm X by Spike Lee and became deeply interested at that point in Islam. He later wrote in his autobiographical statement for the court, "I had first become interested in Islam during 1993 after becoming aware of the Hajj, in which thousands of Muslims from all over the world gather at Mecca, a holy site in Saudi Arabia. I learned that all Muslims are required to make this religious journey at least once in their life. I was very moved by the image of thousands of people praying together, perfectly equal and perfectly humble. I began to read all that I could about Islam." And when he was 16, John formally converted to Islam at a mosque in Mill Valley in Marin County, where we live. And an elder at the Mill Valley Mosque testified in John's case, wrote a statement for the court in which he said that in all of his experience of knowing Americans who had converted to Islam, and I'll quote him here, "No one has come close to John in the embodiment of piety and of the true, noble Islamic character." By the time he was 17, John was ready to embark on a course of study overseas, and he went to Yemen to study Arabic. His first trip to Yemen lasted from July of 98 until May of 99. Then his visa expired, so he came home for a few months. And then in February 2000, just before his 19th birthday, John returned to Yemen to continue his study of classical Arabic and Islam at a school in Sana'a, Yemen. Again, he had visa trouble, though. So in November of 2000, John made a decision to go to Pakistan to continue his Islamic study, memorizing the Quran. It's the goal of every scholarly Muslim to memorize, literally memorize, the entire Quran verbatim. And John's goal here was both to become fluent in Arabic and to memorize that Quran so that he could then go on and become a Muslim scholar. His goal was to attend the Islamic University at Medina in Saudi Arabia, or a comparable world-class Islamic university. And so I always would measure John's desires against that goal, and that's what he was doing as he goes to Pakistan now to study Arabic, and also to study the Quran. So it's November of the year 2000 then when John goes to Pakistan with my blessing. I told John that he could go with my blessing, and I wished him well. In the summer of 2001, the next summer, in late April, John wrote to me and his mother to say that he wanted to go up to the mountains of Pakistan to get away from the heat. And that made sense. John never tolerated very well the heat in Washington, D.C. What he didn't tell us, what we didn't learn until later, was that John was going over the mountains into Afghanistan, intent on volunteering for military service in the Army of Afghanistan. This brings me to a sort of another context aspect here, the geopolitical context of Afghanistan. The Soviet Union, as you know, invaded Afghanistan in 1979. They imposed a puppet government upon the country, communist government. And from the time of that invasion right up through 2001, Afghanistan was engulfed in constant war. After the Soviets withdrew, the country really descended into a civil war among the factions, many of whom had been funded by the United States in the war against the Soviet. And the consequent civil war resulted in terrible devastation in the country. Afghanistan had by far the largest refugee population in the world. And many of these refugees lived in terrible conditions in refugee camps in Pakistan across the border. Eventually, the Taliban, which rose up out of those refugee camps, managed to consolidate power over most of the country. And so by the year 2001, they had consolidated power over all except for the northeastern region of the country, which was still controlled by the Russian-backed Northern Alliance, a group of warlords. Now, America's allegiance with the anti-Russian factions in Afghanistan extended not only through the presidency of Carter, Reagan, and the first President Bush, but also to the current Bush administration. In the spring of 2001, roughly at the same time John went to Afghanistan, Secretary of State Colin Powell personally announced a grant of $43 million to the Taliban government for opium eradication, which the New York Times then refers to as, quote, a first cautious step toward reducing the isolation of the Taliban by the new Bush administration. Secretary of State Powell himself released a press release in which he said, "We will continue to look for ways to provide more assistance to the Afghans." This is the context in which John now goes to Afghanistan. When he did go into Afghanistan, John received just sort of ordinary infantry training at a government-run military training camp. But the training camp was funded by Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden really had two operations going on here. One was to finance the Afghan army operations, these training camps for infantry. But he also, as we all know now, had a terrorist organization underway, a highly secretive terrorist organization that we call Al-Qaeda. Twice in the course of his study or his training there in the camp that summer, John actually saw Osama bin Laden and met him on one occasion. And he came away from those encounters very skeptical about bin Laden because John recognized instantly that bin Laden was not an authentic Islamic scholar, based on what John himself knows. In the course of John's subsequent criminal case, his attorneys hired a professor named Rohan Gunaratne. He's literally the world's leading authority on Al-Qaeda. This is a copy of his book, Inside Al-Qaeda. Gunaratne has been employed by the United Nations, but also by the government of the United States as an expert in Al-Qaeda. And he interviewed John extensively, and after all these interviews made this following conclusion: those who, like Mr. Lin, merely fought the Northern Alliance cannot be deemed terrorists. Their motivation was to serve and to protect suffering Muslims in Afghanistan, not to kill civilians. After the September 11th attacks, the United States then goes to war with Afghanistan. There's a period of 1 month in which the United States attempts to negotiate the extradition of bin Laden and his terrorist group. Those negotiations failed, and so in October, almost a month later, the United States begins an invasion. I wanted to introduce an important player, though, in these events. It's a notorious Northern Alliance warlord named Abdul Rashid Dostum. Dostum had served as an officer in the Soviet-backed puppet government, the communist puppet government in Afghanistan. The New Yorker magazine last year said he was perhaps Afghanistan's most notorious warlord, and he's viewed by most human rights organizations as among the worst war criminals in the country. Throughout the 1990s, as well as during the U.S. invasion of 2001, Dostum was involved in numerous documented cases of torture and murder of prisoners of war. He dominates an area of north-central Afghanistan around the city of Mazar-e-Sharif. And I speak often at law schools, as I tell the law students, General Dostum is really Saddam Hussein on a small scale. In the period in late 2001, Taliban forces in northern Afghanistan were overrun by the Northern Alliance forces after an aerial bombing by the United States. The strategy here, the American strategy, was to use Northern Alliance troops as a proxy rather than commit American troops to the ground there. And this may have been a sound military strategy. However, it appears that the American generals who planned this invasion simply made no provision for the handling of the prisoners of war. What happened as a consequence was the murder of thousands of Taliban prisoners by the Northern Alliance. During the period November and December of 2001, the same time when John's case comes to our attention, these war crimes have been documented by Physicians for Human Rights and in the mainstream media here in the United States, including a cover story in Newsweek magazine. So let us return now to the story of John. In early September, before the 11th of September, John arrives at the front line in Tahar. It's the most northeastern province in Afghanistan on the border of Tajikistan. This is truly the most remote place in the world. It's said that this was as far as Alexander the Great got on his conquest of Asia. This is the farthest he was able to go. So it really is the outskirts of civilization. The two armies there, the Taliban army and the Northern Alliance army, were locked in an old-fashioned stalemate. John arrived. He was issued a standard rifle, two hand grenades, and performed sentry duty there at the front. He never fired his weapons. After the American bombing campaign began in October, the line broke. Again, no American troops are here in Tahar. It's all Northern Alliance troops, but the American bombing happens. The front line breaks. The Taliban soldiers retreat to the capital of Tahar, Kunduz. It's a confused retreat. Many of them are killed. If they're captured by the Northern Alliance, they're killed. There's a chilling series of pictures in the New York Times of a prisoner as he's taken, as he's castrated, and then killed. This is what John faced. He was very desperate and darn near dead by the time he got to Kunduz. Then there's a deal made with General Dostum, the famous General Dostum, for safe passage of these prisoners from Kunduz to a city in the west called Herat, near the border of Iran. And John is one of the 400-some prisoners who are part of this deal with Dostum. I have a photograph here of the regional Taliban commander who's sitting and talking with General Dostum, and they make this deal. A large amount of money is given to Dostum in return for the safe passage. The only condition Dostum imposes is that the soldiers must give up their weapons before he'll allow them to pass through. So they give up the weapons, and then immediately Dostum breaks the deal. He diverts the prisoners from their path into his fortress, a place called Kuala Jungi. And it's an old 15th or 16th century walled fortress near Mazar-e-Sharif. And there, just all hell broke loose. The next morning, John was brought out along with these other prisoners with their hands tied behind their backs for interrogation. There are no American troops present here, but there are two American CIA agents, and they're doing the interrogation of the prisoners as they're brought out of the basement. Their hands are tied. Their arms, I should say, are tied behind their backs at the elbow. They're being very brutally abused by Dostum's troops as this is happening. All of them are afraid that they're going to be killed by General Dostum, given his reputation. John himself is struck in the back of the head with a rifle butt by one of the Northern Alliance troops as he's brought out of the basement just moments before some video was taken of John being interrogated by the two U.S. agents. They threaten John with death, confirming his worst fears that he's in jeopardy of dying. John remains silent. His only goal is to get to Herat. Maybe Dostum will put us back on the road to Herat and I can get back to Pakistan. Moments after this video is shot, though, the last of the remaining 400 or 500 prisoners, as they're brought out of the basement, jumped Dostum's guards, seized their weapons, and a melee broke out. Dostum's troops panicked because this is not a prison. This is Dostum's military headquarters. And right there nearby is a large cache of weapons, Dostum's weaponry. So in a panic, the Dostum guards begin to shoot down all the prisoners in the yard, all of them still with their hands, most of them, like John, with their hands and their arms tied behind their backs. Dozens and dozens of these Taliban prisoners are killed on the spot. John gets up and starts to run. He's shot immediately in the thigh. He gets shot with an AK-47 bullet in the thigh, and he fell to the ground. He lay on the ground there for 12 hours, pretending to be dead while the carnage continues around him. That night, some of the survivors managed to get back down into the basement of that pink building where they had been taken when they first were brought to the fortress, and they went in among the dead and found the wounded and brought them down into the basement. John was one of them. In the days that followed, there was a deliberate effort by Dostum, supported by the United States Special Forces, to simply exterminate all of the Taliban prisoners in the fortress. I will skip over some of these details, but by the end of that week, most of them were dead. John and a group of them were still held up. They were unarmed. They were all wounded. They're in the basement of the fortress. They dropped hand grenades down. They poured burning oil down. At one point, attempted to drop a 1,000-ton bomb, a 1,000-pound bomb on this pink building, but it was misdirected and actually killed some of Dostum's troops, so they stopped with the bombing, but they continued to try to exterminate these prisoners. There was a journalist, a British journalist there named Luke Harding, and he wrote at the time that Dostum's Northern Alliance and his British and American allies had only one plan, to kill all those in the compound. On Friday, the 30th of November, after 6 days, they flooded the basement with water from an irrigation stream, and that killed many of the remaining soldiers down there in the basement. And as Luke Harding wrote, for those who died, it had been a cold, terrifying, and squalid extinction. Oops. Harding wrote, we had expected slaughter, but I was unprepared for its hellish scale. Next, we come to what I call the media storm. John was discovered among the survivors, the 86 survivors of this massacre in the basement of the building, and he instantly became an international sensation. He was quickly dubbed the, quote, American Taliban, unquote, in Newsweek magazine, which initially broke the story. The coverage from the beginning was overwhelmingly negative and prejudicial and falsely linked John with terrorism. After the prisoners emerged from the basement of the fortress, they were taken to Cherbourgen, a town nearby, for medical treatment. They were all starving. They had nothing to eat the entire week. They were suffering from exposure, and they were all pretty much all of them were wounded, including John. John had the AK-47 bullet in his thigh and numerous shrapnel wounds. He was very near death when he arrived at Cherbourgen. As he's lifted onto a gurney for treatment by attending medics, a CNN cameraman named Robert Pelton began to film John. And the tape shows, this is all on the tape, shows John saying to Pelton, look, you don't have my permission to film me. If you're concerned about my welfare, don't film me. The ethical thing to do at that point would have been to turn off the camera. But Robert Pelton did not do the ethical thing. He kept the camera running and the microphone on as John was interviewed. The sensation that resulted from the CNN interview is difficult to describe. I think you probably all have seen it. The interesting thing about the CNN interview, from my perspective, is that it was completely exculpatory. John explained he was injected with morphine, of course, then begins to talk. He forgets about turning off the camera. And he tells his whole story, and it's completely exculpatory. He says everything that I've told you. I was in the Taliban army. I met bin Laden. And then all the terrible events around this massacre. But the effect in the United States at that time, given the post-9/11 mood, was just terrible. The effect of this video seemed to confirm the opposite. It seemed to confirm people's suspicions that John was a terrorist. And it wasn't just the television media that caused this prejudice. It was the print media as well. Newsweek magazine published just a terrible, terrible story, cover story, saying that John had supported the 9/11 attacks, and including the photograph of John as he was dragged out of that basement. The tabloid media was on to the case as well. The National Enquirer, which appeared at grocery store checkout stands throughout the country, featured a cover story with John's picture saying, America's traitor tells all, and with a photograph of John. But even worse than this coverage by the tabloids, I believe, was the treatment John received in the mainstream media, including the New York Times. On Tuesday, the 11th of December, 2001, the Times published a front-page article above the fold featuring a very compelling photograph of the funeral of Mike Spann, the CIA agent who had been killed there at Kuala Jungi at that uprising. And this is at Arlington National Cemetery. His casket is being carried by a Marine Corps honor guard, and following behind is Spann's widow carrying her baby in arms and his father also to her side. The story below that follows is called One for His Country and One Against It. And the theme of the entire story was that John had fought against his country and had caused the death of this Mike Spann, the CIA agent. Interestingly, directly alongside this incredibly damaging article, on page one of the New York Times, there appeared a leading article that same day about the widespread killing of the Taliban prisoners by General Dostum and the Northern Alliance. The byline of the article was Sherbergen, the very place where John had been taken and filmed by the CNN crew. But the New York Times overlooked the fact that this was the context in which John had been found, that John was the fortunate survivor of a mass killing of prisoners by the Northern Alliance. The next chapter of my speech I call Mistreatment by the U.S. Military. Upon his capture, John was quickly transferred from Dostum's custody into the custody of the U.S. military. I would have thought at that point that John was in safe hands. And John himself thought the same thing because he said so in a brief letter that he dictated to the Red Cross, who visited him that first day. But an order emanating directly from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld instructed the U.S. military to, quote, take the gloves off, unquote, in the questioning of John Lind. Rumsfeld's order is documented in a letter that was provided to John's lawyers by the prosecutors, and it also has been reported as a front-page story in the Los Angeles Times. I do not want to dwell here today on the military's mistreatment of my son, but I will say categorically that he was treated in a way that is shameful to our nation and its ideals. John's bullet wound, John's bullet wound was left festering and untreated. He was blindfolded and bound hand and foot with tight plastic strips that caused severe pain. He was stripped naked and duct taped in this condition, blindfolded, bound, and naked to a stretcher, and then left in the cold in an unheated metal shipping container on the desert floor in Afghanistan. After one initial visit, the Red Cross was denied any further access to John. The letters I wrote to John through the Red Cross were never delivered to him. All of this conduct was in violation of the Geneva Conventions of War. It was beyond what any civilized nation should tolerate. Yet, despite the fact that the torture and abuse of John Lind was fully disclosed in the press, there was no outcry here in the United States. So strong was the emotion at that time against this young man. What I find most troubling about this mistreatment, however, was that it was completely gratuitous and unnecessary. John Lind did not need to be tortured in order to tell American forces what he knew, where he had been, and what he had seen. He was glad to be rescued. He had nothing to hide. I cannot fathom why the military would have felt it necessary to humiliate him in this way. My next chapter is called Prejudicial Commentary by Government Officials. Now, this is an interesting subject. I would venture to say that never before in the history of this country has any criminal defendant been subject to anything approaching the kind of prejudicial statements made by officials in John's case. Interestingly, though, at the very beginning, when John was first captured, President Bush had a sympathetic response. He said, "I don't know what we're going to do with the poor fellow," in an interview with Barbara Walters. And he referred to him by name. He said, "John." Senator John McCain had sympathetic words, and Senator Orrin Hatch also said that he thought that John was on a spiritual quest. But after the CNN interview was aired, the whole mood shifted, and by mid-December, there was a flood of prejudicial commentary by government officials, and it's both parties. It's not just Republicans. It's both Republicans and Democrats. All of these statements were broadcast and covered in the national media and came into everyone's home in the country. In an Oval Office interview on December 21st, President Bush said, "Obviously, Walker is unique in that he's the first American al-Qaeda fighter we've captured." John had never even heard of al-Qaeda. Senator Hillary Clinton, in a nationally televised interview on Meet the Press, calls John a traitor. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld says John Lind was captured by U.S. forces with an AK-47 in his hands. Imagine the prejudice to John from such a false and inflammatory statement. Secretary of State Colin Powell, the same Colin Powell who had sent the money to Afghanistan in April, says John Walker Lind has brought shame upon his family. Former President George Herbert Walker Bush says this, "He's just despicable. I thought of a unique penalty. Make him leave his hair the way it is and his face as dirty as it is, and let him go wandering around this country and see what kind of sympathy he would get." This is on Good Morning America, December 19th. The Speaker of the House of Representatives, Dennis Hassert, said that John was a, quote, terrorist, unquote, who belonged to, quote, an organization that took American lives and came against the American Constitution. Senator McCain, he says, quote, I'd like to take him to ground zero and show him ground zero and see how he feels after that. Rudy Giuliani was the person of the year in Time magazine, and what does he do with that bully pulpit? Look at the statement he makes about my son. He says, when you commit treason against the United States of America, particularly at a time when the U.S. is in peril of further attack, I believe the death penalty is the appropriate remedy to consider. But the most prejudicial commentary of all came from Attorney General Ashcroft. He held two nationally televised press conferences in John's case. In the first, I have a copy here of the New York Times, page one article in the first of those press conferences. The first was on the 15th of February. Mind you, John is still overseas, still hasn't even had a chance to visit with his lawyer. He said, the Attorney General says, quote, we cannot overlook attacks on America when they come from the United States citizens. This is announcing the criminal complaint against John. He's the leading prosecutor in the United States. The same day, he says, we may never know why he turned his back on our country and its values, but we cannot ignore that he did. Youth is not absolution for treachery, and personal self-discovery is not an excuse to take up arms against one's country. In the second of these conferences, February 2nd, announcing the indictment, the Attorney General says, the reasons for his choices may never be fully known to us, but the fact of those choices is clear. Americans who love their country do not dedicate themselves to killing Americans. As any lawyer would know, it is a breach of professional ethics for a prosecutor to make prejudicial comments about a criminal defendant who is awaiting trial. Even if the things the prosecutor says are true, it is unethical for the prosecutor to inflame public opinion against a criminal defendant. The prosecutor's job is to prove the case in court. But when a prosecutor makes the kind of statements that the Attorney General made about my son, statements that are not only inflammatory but false, it's almost unimaginable. Mr. Attorney General, have you no decency, sir? And then we get to the criminal case, which the Boston Globe refers to as a collapsed terror case. Initially, the government charged John with 11 criminal counts, most of them terrorism-related charges, such as supporting al-Qaeda. And in the end, the government dropped all of the terrorism-related charges in a plea bargain. The one charge that John pleaded guilty to was providing assistance to the Taliban government in violation of the economic sanctions that President Clinton had imposed. I think it's clear that the government really had to stretch to find any criminal statute that John's conduct had actually violated. But for that one offense, and because he carried a weapon in the commission of the offense, John has been sentenced to 20 years in federal prison, and he's serving that sentence now in Southern California. Now, an interesting contrast may be found in the government's disposition of the case of Yasser Hamdi. He's another 20-year-old. He was picked up with John he's another survivor of the massacre at Kuala Jungi. He likewise had been up in the front line in Tahar. Initially, the government, now Yasser Hamdi is like John in every respect except one. He is a United States citizen, but he's actually Saudi Arabian. He was born in Baton Rouge, but grew up in Saudi Arabia to Saudi Arabian parents, so he has dual citizenship. And the government initially held Hamdi and said that they could simply hold him indefinitely without charges. And a very courageous public defender named Frank Dunham took the case all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court held that the government had no such power to hold a citizen indefinitely without charges. And after the Supreme Court's ruling, the government released Hamdi and sent him home to his family in Saudi Arabia. The only condition imposed was that he had to relinquish his dual U.S. citizenship. And so we were left with the peculiar result that John Lind is serving a 20-year prison sentence for the same conduct as Yasser Hamdi, and Yasser Hamdi has been sent home to his family in Saudi Arabia. On the basis of the inherent unfairness in this result, and also the fact that John has been a model prisoner from the beginning, John's lawyers have filed a petition with President Bush asking that John's sentence be commuted, and that petition currently is pending with the president. Quickly, I have three conclusions I'd like to say based on the facts of John's case. First, The citizens, the rights we enjoy as citizens under the Constitution are vulnerable at times of war and national crisis, and they can be undermined by politicians and the media. Recall that every one of the government officials who I quoted took an oath of loyalty to the Constitution when they were sworn into office, and yet look how quick they were to disregard the Constitution in order to make rhetorical points about John Lind. As I tell law students when I speak with them about John's case, the Constitution of the United States does not live in a vault at the National Archives. The Constitution lives in our hearts. And it's up to us as people to maintain the values embedded in the Constitution. We cannot trust the politicians and the media to do the job for us. I think I have to say, too, it was only the intervention of a courageous legal team headed by Jim Brosnahan that literally saved my son's life. I cannot even contemplate what might have happened if these lawyers had not stepped up to defend John. Excuse me. Second, I think it's clear that the United States really made a mistake in treating Taliban foot soldiers in the Afghan army as if they were Al-Qaeda terrorists. This was unjust in the eyes of the whole world, but especially among Muslims. And finally, I hope you will indulge me when I say that the mistreatment and the imprisonment of John Lind was and is a human rights violation. It was based purely on an emotional response to the 9/11 attacks and not on an objective assessment of John's case. Thank you for your attention. I would be happy now to answer your questions.
Our thanks to Frank Lind for his comments today. Now it's time that we turn over to the question and answer portion of the program. We have an interesting set of questions ahead.
Fire away.
Do you believe, one questioner asked, that your son in any way betrayed his country?
Absolutely not. John's conduct in going to Afghanistan was consonant with something like 20 or 25 years of U.S. policy in Afghanistan. You may recall President Reagan made repeated speeches both before and during his presidency, in which he referred to the Mujahideen, these freedom fighters, as freedom fighters. He said they're the moral equivalent of our founding fathers. It was a strong United States, a history of strong United States support for freedom fighters. John was one of an estimated 100,000 young Muslim males who volunteered for military service in Afghanistan during this 20-year period following the Soviet invasion. And in no sense can it be said that John's conduct in going there was contrary to the interests of the United States. It was completely consonant with 20 years of American policy. What happened, unfortunately, for John was that the United States made an abrupt change after the 9/11 attacks. We switched sides. We began to align ourselves abruptly and completely in a departure from what had happened before with the Northern Alliance. John was on the ground there when that happened. He's caught at that point, but he certainly didn't go to Afghanistan to do anything against America. He never fought against America. He never held a gun against an American soldier. He was simply rescued.
If you were to meet George W. Bush today, what would you say to him?
I think I would say, President Bush, as one father to another, I would ask that you please let my son out of prison and apologize for what happened here.
That segues to a related question. Do you feel any personal guilt about what has happened to your son?
No. I feel very proud of my son. John behaved with absolute integrity throughout this ordeal. He's a wonderful kid. He's got a great sense of humor. His spirits are good. It's remarkable what he's been through and the fact that his spirits are so good after all that. So I'm very proud of my son. He has more integrity and more dignity than any politician or any journalist that I've ever met. I mean that. So I'm very proud of him, and I'm not ashamed. I think it's a wonderful thing for an American kid to go overseas and study and to learn a foreign language, and to learn another culture, to learn another religion. These are good things. This is what America's all about. John is, as I say to law students, John is exemplifying our Constitution. The Constitution gives us the right of freedom of religion. It gives us the right of freedom of expression and freedom of association. These are our cherished rights as citizens. John was exercising every one of those rights. The Constitution also gives us certain rights as against the government if it chooses to accuse us of a crime. It guarantees us a right to a jury, an impartial jury. It guarantees the right to be presumed innocent. Poor John was presumed guilty before he ever got back into the United States because of all that prejudicial commentary by the government officials and by the intensive hyperbolic media coverage. The kid was presumed guilty of the worst sort of crimes when he was brought back for trial. So no, I have nothing to be ashamed of with regard to my son. Do I wish that he hadn't gone to Afghanistan? You bet. You bet I wish that. And I think John wishes that too. In fact, I know John prepared and delivered a very beautiful statement to the court in Alexandria when he was sentenced, in which he said, "If I knew then what I know now about the Taliban, I would never have gone into Afghanistan. I went to Afghanistan in order to help people, not to hurt them." So how could you be anything other than proud about a son like that?
As you seek commutation, do you think that John would stand a better chance with a Democratic president, and why?
I don't think John would stand a better chance with a Democratic president. We saw, there were other statements I didn't quote, but you saw the statement from Senator Hillary Clinton. It was very brutal. And, you know, Senator Clinton is a trained lawyer. She knows about these rules around criminal defendants and how they're treated. So it was very unkind. But there were other statements I could have quoted. Barbara Boxer said terrible things about my son in the media. So I don't necessarily think it's a partisan issue where the Republicans are the bad guys and the Democrats are the good guys. And I believe in my heart that President Bush really does it, ultimately really want to do the right thing. And if the facts of John's case come clear to him, I think John has as good a chance of being released by President Bush as he would under any president.
For the radio audience, I'd like to remind everyone that we're listening to Frank Lynn, the father of John Walker Lynn at the Commonwealth Club of California. The situation is obviously and understandably emotional for you and your family, but do you have any level of understanding for the way people responded in the months following the prison incident?
Yes, I think I've reflected on this a lot. I think we all understand the trauma and the grief that the nation suffered in the 9/11 attacks. And I think to some extent it's human nature to want to take that grief and that anger out on somebody. It's a normal human reaction. And I have to understand, and I understood it from the very beginning, that John was in the crosshairs of that emotion at that moment. He came along at the wrong time and in the wrong place. And I understand human emotion, and the people wanted to blame someone and to get someone. You know, we didn't get bin Laden. He's still out there somewhere. We didn't capture him. We didn't capture his top people, at least not initially. But we did get John Lind, and he was just there, and he was the focal point of all of that anger and all that grief and all of that emotion. And I do understand it. I do understand it. But it's not right. It's not right because he is an innocent.
Can you tell us, please, how often do you and your wife visit your son? And what can you tell us about his life in prison?
It's my ex-wife, Marilyn, and I and our other two kids visit John regularly. We try to stagger our visits so we maximize the hours. The silver lining in this whole cloud is that we have wonderful visits with John in the prison down in Southern California. The visiting hours are long. We sit in a large crowded room much like this, and we can talk in privacy due to the sort of the noise level in the room, and we talk about all kinds of things. It's not, you know, John will be 25 in a few weeks. Ordinarily, a son who's 25 years old doesn't have much time to sit and talk with his father, but what I get to do with John is we sit and talk. I mean, typical weekend, the same is true for his mother. A typical weekend is we'll sit and talk on Friday night for 2 to 3 hours, on Saturday for 5 hours, and Sunday for 5 hours. And we have nothing to do but talk. So we do visit, and we have wonderful visits, and John's spirits are good, and he continues to do well. He continues to be a devout, practicing Muslim and to pursue his study of the Quran.
You mentioned during your presentation your Catholic upbringing. One of the members of the audience asked, how did you feel about your young son embracing a religion different from your own and traveling to countries that could be potentially unsafe for Americans? Didn't this cause any fear in you at all?
First, I really embraced, and John's mother did too, John's conversion to Islam. I remain a practicing Catholic, but I have a deep respect for Islam. I have a deep respect for Judaism. In my mind, these are all three different variants on a theme. So I'm quite happy to have a son that becomes a Muslim. I love Islam. I respect Islam. So there's no trepidation, and there never was from the beginning about John's conversion to Islam. About his study overseas, I mean, I could send a kid to Belfast, Northern Ireland, and feel pretty worried about that, too. I mean, if you want to, if you want your child to pursue his dream and his heart, and it involves going overseas to a place like Yemen or Israel or Northern Ireland, I don't think a parent is likely to stand in the way of that. If it's a legitimate need, there's a legitimate need to go there. It's to study something that can best be learned in that environment. We did not hold back. Yes, we had trepidation. Each time we took John to the airport in San Francisco, there were lots of tears shed, lots of nervous feeling about what's it going to be like over there. Yemen is a very different country from ours. So sure, there's some uncertainty and some trepidation, but no regret and no doubt that it was the right thing for John. And why is that? It's because it was in his heart. This is what John wanted.
In an email you had written to your son in 2000, "I trust your judgment and hope you have a wonderful adventure." This is as he's setting off for that part of the world. Was your trust misplaced?
Well, yes and no. I didn't mistrust John in going to Pakistan to pursue the memorization of the Quran, because, in fact, John did go to Pakistan and pursue the memorization of the Quran, and he continues that study today. So he did what he told me he would do. When John made the decision later in April to volunteer for what he thought would be a summer of military service in the Army of Afghanistan, that was the one step on his long journey where he didn't check in with me and get my permission. If he had asked me, I think you know my answer would have been absolutely not, John. We don't have a stake in that fight. Stay out of Afghanistan. If you want to do some good, go to the refugee camps and help the people there. I wouldn't have approved his going into Afghanistan. But was my trust misplaced? No. But, you know, John was a 20-year-old young man in a foreign country. I think I also should say that the region of Pakistan where John was is a Pashtun region. The Pashtun people occupy both sides of this border in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. And from the Pashtun people's point of view, the Taliban were the good guys and the Northern Alliance were the bad guys. So John kind of fell into that worldview as he's there in that environment. He made his own choice. He didn't get brainwashed or unduly influenced by anybody. John deliberately made his own choice. He's a kind of a headstrong young man. So he went over the border on his own volition. I wish he hadn't done it, but I don't think my trust in John overall was misplaced.
What are your son's feelings about the American soldiers fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, and what are his present feelings about Osama bin Laden?
Well, I need to say that John is subject to what are called special administrative measures that are imposed by the Attorney General. It's a unilateral thing. It's different from and apart from his plea agreement. In the plea agreement, John agrees to serve 20 years in prison. But the Attorney General Ashcroft, also imposed on John what are called special administrative measures. These were developed for use with terrorism convicts. If we had, for example, Osama bin Laden in prison, you would not want him to be able to communicate to the outside. And so John is under these restrictions despite the fact that he's not a terrorist and has no terrorism conviction. We have not much choice about that. I think John's attorneys eventually hope to negotiate those away. But in the meantime, those measures require that none of us, John's family or John's attorneys, can communicate directly or indirectly anything that John tells us to a crowd like this or to the media. In fact, there was a case in New York recently, you might have seen, a woman named Lynn Stewart, a defense attorney, who broke one of those rules in defending a man they call the Blind Sheik, who was involved in the terrorist bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. And Lynn Stewart has been convicted of a criminal. She has a criminal conviction and may well face a very lengthy prison sentence. So it's a long way of answering. I cannot tell you what John thinks about anything without running into jeopardy of violating those SAMs, and so I can't do that.
We're listening to Frank Lind on the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Why do you think that John did not tell you that he had joined the Army? And did you hear from him between the time that he joined the Army and the time that he was captured?
Let me start with the last part of that. We did not hear from John until we read about his capture in the Newsweek magazine. So we went for 7 months not knowing where he was. And as that summer went on, we got his mother and I, but especially his mother, got increasingly worried. Where's John? Where's John? And after September 11th, after the terrorist attacks, we were really distraught. And yet we had no idea how to find him. Later, I learned that John had tried to send a letter from Pakistan, but I don't think the mail service in that part of the world is too good. So essentially we went with no communication after the April emails to me and his mother in which he said, I'm going to the mountains for the summer. So we had no further communication until he was picked up by the U.S. forces after the massacre at Gwalajungi.
Do you think that turmoil at home, including your 1999 divorce, could have in any way contributed to his rootlessness that brought him to that part of the world?
That's an interesting question. I wouldn't ever characterize John as rootless. John is very rooted in his country of origin, in his religion, and in his family. So the implication of your question is flawed, I think. We did divorce, Marilyn and I, in 1999, and no divorce is easy. It's always painful for the parents, and it's especially painful for the children. But I can't answer for you what effect that might have had on John. Frankly, at that point of his life, John was already moving overseas. He had long since made his conversion. He had long since made his decision that he wanted to go to Yemen to study. So I don't see any cause and effect given the timing between the divorce that Marilyn and I went through and John's decision to go overseas to study.
A member of the audience asks, as I understand it, you have been refusing to give interviews. Why have you chosen to speak now?
Well, we're still not giving interviews. We had a terrible time in our family with the media in this country, and I'm talking here about the mainstream media. There wasn't a single major newspaper or a single major television or radio outlet in the United States that did not disparage our son and accuse him of terrorism at that time. John could not get a fair shake in the media, nothing close to it. And it was also one of these hysterical kind of media cases like the O.J. Simpson case, in which the family just became vulnerable to having these reporters prowling around and camped out on our front lawns and everything. Initially, in the very first couple of days, I did agree to speak. I was interviewed on Larry King's show on my birthday, December 3rd of 2001, and I did a couple of other interviews the next morning on some of those morning TV shows. But other than that, we've really essentially not granted interviews to the media. There were one or two exceptions. We talked to Time magazine, somewhat to our regret. We talked to People magazine, but on the whole, the family have not opened up to questioning by the media. We just don't want to open that Pandora's box. Someday maybe we will, but we're not ready to do that today. On the other hand, I am ready to stand up and speak on my son's behalf directly to people like yourselves. I've been speaking at law schools. I spoke last week at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communication. There are audiences that are prepared to listen to the true story of John and to think about what happened. And I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to talk directly to people. But what I'm not willing to do, what we as a family are not willing to do, at least at this point, is talk to the media.
Do you think your son received a bad deal in taking a 20-year plea agreement, 20 years in prison, to end the case?
Well, yes, I think he got a bad deal. He didn't do anything wrong. I call this the case of the crimeless crime. There's actually no crime. John committed no crime. He's not even accused of committing any real crime. He's accused of violating what are called economic sanctions against the Taliban. But there is no crime here in the ordinary sense in John's conduct. There is, of course, a horrific crime behind all of this, which is the 9/11 terrorist attacks. So John's essentially kind of taking the heat for something he had no involvement in. Now, at the time, you have to remember back, think about the prejudicial effect that all that media coverage would have had on this kid as he's brought back to the United States to face trial before a jury in Northern Virginia. The government brought him back deliberately into Northern Virginia, just a few miles from the Pentagon, with a jury pool that was heavily influenced by the intemperate comments by the Attorney General. And to make matters worse, the judge scheduled John's trial for the anniversary of 9/11. So in that atmosphere, to think that John would have gotten a fair trial is fatuous. And he faced a 40-year sentence for serving in the Taliban army, and several life sentences for these other false charges that the government had brought against him. And in that environment, I think to strike a deal and take a 20-year sentence, it's difficult to swallow. The morning after the thing was agreed to, I woke up and in those early morning moments when your mind's not clear, I thought to myself, gee, 10 years, that's terrible. That's a long time. And then my mind came clear and I realized, oh, Lord, no, it's 20 years. So that's an awful long sentence for someone who committed no crime. But in the atmosphere of the time where he faced these multiple life sentences and in a heavily emotionally charged atmosphere and a kind of a poisoned jury pool, I think it's a very good deal that he got. And I think it's the best he could have hoped for. And I hope, by making a presentation of this kind, that over time people will begin to reflect back and think back to that time and realize that this kid really was an innocent person who took the blame for something he didn't do, and that public opinion will turn and will shift. And at some point, the president, some president, will release John Early. I remain optimistic about that.
Do you think if there was a trial today, the results would be different? And was there any effort to delay the trial so you could move away from the emotions of that time?
John's lawyers did a lot of things to try to stem the emotional impact at the time. They asked for postponement of the trial. They asked to move a venue from Washington area out here to San Francisco, which is John's home. All these motions were denied by the judge. So it was kind of a railroad that was just moving right along. I used to say this court is like bumper bowling for prosecutors. There was simply nothing John's lawyers could do with the court in Alexandria to get any kind of fairness for him as he approached the prospect of this jury trial. Now, I forget the rest of your question.
That's fine. Some critics have called your family's response to your son's actions as indulgent or blind to the harm that he caused. How do you respond?
Well, my first response is he caused no harm whatsoever. He's accused of things. That's the assumption of the question like that is, oh, John's one of those terrorists who bombed our country. How do you feel about that, Mr. Lind, as his father? I hope you understand the assumption behind that question is dramatically false. That's how I would answer.
Could you please discuss some of the other cases of converted Muslim citizens in the West that were imprisoned for their involvement with the Taliban or al-Qaeda, such as Jose Padilla and others? Are there parallels in these cases?
The case that I'm most struck by is the Hamdi case. Hamdi is not a terrorist. He didn't join al-Qaeda or have any connection, as far as we know, with terrorism. He simply joined the Taliban army, and he served in Tahrir along with John. And he's gone home to his family. That's the most compelling case. These other cases that you refer to involve people who actually are accused. Now, whether the government can prove these cases objectively and fairly, that remains to be seen. But they're accused of involvement with actual terrorist activities, a big distinction between being a soldier in an army and being involved in terrorist activities. So I see a huge distinction between the case of John Lind or Yasser Hamdi and the cases involving people who are accused of plotting or carrying out terrorist attacks.
Audience member here at the Commonwealth Club asks, why has this case been under the radar, rarely getting much media or other attention, even in Marin County, which is supposedly a progressive community? Why are there no protests if the case is so egregious as you portray it?
Well, I think you have to remember back to the time that John became a household name in America. And associated with that notoriety was this infamous notion that he was involved in the terrorist attacks of 9/11. I have a brother who's involved in politics, and he said, you guys better do something to get John's positive ratings into double digits. He was extremely unpopular in the United States and probably still is because of the way his case was portrayed by the government and by the media. And so it doesn't surprise me that there's not a huge outcry on John's behalf. There will over time, though. There will be a shift. People will come to realize that what happened in his case was wrong, that the torture was wrong, that the false accusations were wrong. And eventually, public opinion, I'm confident, will shift. I think American people fundamentally are fair and decent. And decent and fair people will come to recognize John for what he is. He's an innocent, decent young man, a scholarly, interesting, curious, good-humored, good-natured young man. And it will happen. He will be released from prison one day.
You've been quoted as comparing your son to Nelson Mandela, and I wonder if you perhaps today think maybe that was overstating the case.
I got in a lot of trouble for saying that. It was an emotional time in front of the courthouse at the time of the sentence, and I was thinking of that 20 years. But I did really say to John, I said, Nelson Mandela served some 20 years or more in prison. And I was trying to steal John for that prospect. I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity or faced the necessity of trying to brace your child for a 20-year prison sentence. a young man of 19 or 20 years old. So I'm trying to give John some courage to go into that and to hang in there and to have fortitude. And so I said it. I said, John, Nelson Mandela did it, and he came out of prison with his integrity intact and his head held high, and that's what I expect of you. That's what I hope for you. And then I said it in front of the courthouse, and I got a lot of trouble for it, but I don't regret saying it.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. And I would like to ask, if you would, what do you think will really happen with your son? Will he end up serving out the 20-year sentence? Perhaps I ask you more as a lawyer than as a father, but, I mean, do you think there's a real chance that your efforts for clemency or for commutation of sentence will succeed?
Well, I think all of us involved, John's legal team and John himself, I think we all have to recognize and do recognize that the odds are against it. When you think back again to those days in 2001 and early 2002 when all these statements were being made about John by, again, the most powerful politicians in our country, it's difficult to envision a situation in which all those, those hotheads in Washington would turn around and say, you know what, we were wrong. The kid got a raw deal and he should be released. I recognize those are long odds. But again, I have faith in the ordinary people of this country that they do believe in decency and in human rights. They do believe in the Constitution. And that as the facts of John's case begin to get into the public consciousness in a time when we're not emotionally distraught as we were after 9/11, that there will be a different view of John's case. And I do believe that he will be released early. But I also caution and I tell John that you have to be prepared to serve the full time. And so use the time well. Use it to study, continue your education, maintain your integrity. And if he has to serve the full term, he'll be out in about 15 more years, 14 to 15 years. And if that's what it takes, well, we'll just continue to have those weekend visits until that time.
I thank you very much, Frank Lind, father of John Walker Lind, for his comments today. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Adam Tanner, the San Francisco Bureau Chief for Reuters, and for now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of discussion, is adjourned.